This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning. It is Sunday, August 26th, 2012. Today's topic in the halachic process is that of legislation. We're having a little bit of a discussion before we put the recording on the sources of authority. And we had given a class several weeks ago, I don't even remember how long ago, on some of the claims that Chazal gave to their own authority. And a lot of it comes down to some part of a tradition that they are designated by God in some way to continue the Jewish legal system, either by certain acts of legislation that we'll see a little bit later on today, by interpretation, which we saw in the last class, or just in general continuing the tradition that came down from Moses. All right? So here's an example. Start us off then. Mishnah Avot 1:1.
Moses received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets handed it down to the men of the great assembly. They said three things: be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and make a fence around the Torah.
All right. So, and we've seen this before, right? This discusses, like, how did the sages get their authority? I mean, this kind of, condenses, several hundred years of history into a couple of lines. But it's basically all coming from Moshe, from Moses. So when the men of the great assembly received whatever tradition they had from Moses, it's as if what they said is part of one unbroken chain. Today we're going to focus on that last line, or really those last three words, v'asu seyad l'Torah, to make a fence around the Torah. So, and this is where, really gets into a lot of the rabbinic innovation. Last class that we had, we spoke about rabbinic interpretation, right? With that, you can say, oh, these are innovative reads, but the basis for the authority that the rabbis are giving is, this is in the Bible, this is a pasuk. As being a verse of some, divinely inspired document. I use that term because it doesn't just apply to, the Torah, which comes from God. You will find various expositions in some way or another, or even a smachtot or something, and a smachtot is something on which is relied on from the books of the prophets and writings, which are considered to be, sacred documents in their own right. But there is some other, almost direct appeal to a divine authority in some way, shape, or form when you go back to a pre-existing biblical text. When you talk about Seyag LaTorah, fence around the Torah, that's where Chazal, the sages, exercise more of their legislative autonomy to basically come up with brand new stuff. That's what the focus is going to be on today.
Yes. Asu Seyag LaTorah is not the word of God.
Correct.
Baal Tosif is.
We're going to discuss that. So one way that you can say that, where do Chazal have these rights? So if you say, first off, we remember when we did the thing with Baal Tosif before, that it wasn't so much of, creating new things out of the blue, but it was, adding certain things to the Torah. We also saw that it was pretending that it was the will of God. We'll have a separate class on Chumrot, on stringencies, and how those fit in. But a Seyag offense has a particular intention. There's a point to it. No one claims that it is the will of God. So let's do one example. And there are, quite a few of these. So there's a discussion at the very beginning of Brachot of, how late at night can you say Kriyat Shema? So one opinion is that you can do it all the way up until Kriyat Shema at night, I should say. One opinion is that you can do all the way up until night. So Gemara and Bracha, though, in 4b says, in reality, is Rabban Gamliel's view that they adopted. And the reason for saying until midnight, meaning, according to the opinion that says the time that you have to say Kriyat Shema at night is until midnight, is to keep a man far from transgression. For so it has been taught, the sages made a fence for their words, so that a man, on returning home from the field in the evening, should not say, I'll go home, eat a little, and drink a little, sleep a little, and then I'll recite the Shema and the Tefillah, and meanwhile, sleep may overpower him, and as a result, he'll sleep the whole night. So what's the deal? You're supposed to say Kriyat Shema at night, You set up a time saying, oh, you have to say Kriyat Shema by midnight, even though technically you could say Kriyat Shema all night long, right? Because there is a siyag, there was a fence around the Torah to say, no, we're going to say, do it at midnight. Why? Because if you do it at midnight, if you don't have that sort of, you know, buffer, then you might say, yeah, you know what, I got plenty of time. I'm just going to sleep it off, and then you're going to wind up missing it. So what is a siyag? What is a fence? It's an idiom to use as a matter of protection. The analogy that was given when I, you know, first heard of a siyag Torah in school was, you think of, you know, the Torah as a cliff, right? If you break the Torah, you fall off a cliff. What do you do to prevent from falling off a cliff? You put up a fence a couple of meters in, you know, not that that's the cliff, but it's so that you don't fall off a cliff. Or, you know, for anyone in New York, that yellow strip that they have by the subways, right? You know, yes, you couldn't, you know, the goal is to not get hit by a subway as it comes down. If you stand, like, on the black part before the yellow strip, you're not going to get hit by a subway, right? So, because here, there's no, you know, there's no illusion that it's a matter of, you know, that this is what God actually wants you to do, as much as setting up a rule that may be stricter than what the technical biblical requirement might be, so that you won't come to violate biblical law.
It's just there's no end to that.
Separate
sides of the street for men and women.
Ah, so interesting point there. Actually, you know what? I didn't include that here. I get a pen. I need to put that in. Forgot about that. So, all right. I'm going to have to add this for an updated version of the class. So you say in Le Devar Sof. So there are Gemara that talk about you don't have a fence around a fence. I apologize for not including that here. It honestly slipped my mind. But that was a great point. It really has to go in here. Because in theory, you could be right. Because, you know, is it 10 meters from the end of the cliff? Or is it 50? Or do you have another fence? Right. So there's a... you don't set up Xera around Xera, and there are other types of restrictions that they have on such legislations, which we'll see towards the end.
I don't know, this is a waste of time for your audience, but when we travel out west, and we're at the rim of the Grand Canyon or something like that, we say to ourselves, it's a good thing this wasn't in New York State, because we would never be able to get within 20 feet of it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm not sure if I should use it. Yeah, never mind. We'll skip the bad joke.
Okay.
So now you want to talk about, you know, some extreme examples here. Go to Yevamot 90b.
Come in here. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov stated, I heard that even without any Pentateuchal authority for their rulings, Beit Din may administer flogging and death penalties, not, however, for the purpose of transgressing the words of the Torah, but in order to make offense for the Torah. And it once happened that a man rode on horseback on the Sabbath in the days of the Greeks, and he was brought before the Beit Din and was stoned, not because he deserved the penalty, but because the exigencies of the hour demanded it. And another incident occurred with a man who had intercourse with his wife under a fig tree, and he was brought before Beit Din and flogged, not because he deserved such a penalty, but because the exigencies of the hour demanded it. To safeguard a cause is different.
Yeah. So you could, right? Now this, you know, is taking this idea of a siyag to, you know, I think a pretty big, I mean, you don't get much more extreme than killing someone, right? Here there is an acknowledgement, though, that, you know, Beit Din, that the punishment that they meted out is not technical biblical law. And I think that's a very important distinction there. Meaning, you know, one of the things that we saw with Baal Tosef was passing off certain legislation as your own, as, you know, biblical. It's like, hey, this is what God wants, versus saying, no, this is Beit Din operating under on our own specific unique authority. All right. Now, at the end result, I mean, the dead person is still dead, and it doesn't do them, you know, much. Well, I shouldn't say it doesn't do them much good, depending on what the death penalty does.
Right.
But the dead person is still dead. But when you think about it from a perspective of a legal system, right, it is very important to know whence the authority comes. Right. There's no, again, here, there is that explicit statement that it is not coming from God. It's coming from the Beit Din. Where does Beit Din get that authority? Well, that was the class a couple of weeks ago where they get, you know, the tradition there, right? So they do have an authority to make certain, you know, even ad hoc legislations as a matter of a susiyag, where there's actually offense. Yeah.
A case like that, there's the opposite spin to it in the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, where in the end the temple was destroyed because somebody insisted we cannot sacrifice a blemished animal lest people say we're lenient.
Right. And you also, I mean, you also have other Gemaras that say that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed not because the Batei Din acted kedin and not lifnei mishurat hadin. They acted by the law and not above and beyond the law. You know, there's a matter of authority and there's a matter of how things can be used. The big problem, you know, the big flaw that you have with this sort of approach of, you know, you can kill someone as a matter of siag l'Torah, is that you're leaving it up to human judgment. And human judgments can be flawed. Questions today of Hora'at Sha'ah. My father even has an article about this that, you know, if you're interested, I think I can dig up for you, on Hora'at Sha'ah. And it is, you know, my sense is that it is kind of tricky, because what one person sees as a Hora'at Sha'ah, someone else doesn't. Like, you know, take this shul, for example. The custom used to be here that when, if there were only nine people, they'd open up the aron and count the open aron as a minyan. And I, you know, put a right stop to that. And, you know, one of the arguments that people gave is like, oh, you're allowed to do it for shatat chak, for some emergency situation, horacha, some emergency dispensation thing there. Now, whether or not you are or aren't, set that question aside. But my counter was, this isn't an emergency situation, right? You've got, you know, at least a dozen other minyanim, right, around in the neighborhood. People want to have a minyan. Like, people not getting up to daven for shul isn't an emergency. Like, maybe if you're the only shul in a 300-mile radius, right, maybe you can say there's some sort of emergency dispensation, but is this a dispensation because someone doesn't get up for shul? Or because, you know, people insist on dafka having a minyan at a particular location at a particular time, even when there are, you know, at least 12 in the neighborhood? Right? Is that really Hora'at? So people can judge differently what's considered a real Hora'at Sha'ah. People can argue over, well, what's the appropriate response to Hora'at Sha'ah? But you always have to think of, you know, what are the consequences going to be of the action? So in your case, you know, about bringing up the animal, you know, maybe had they, you know, done it, you know, brought it in, that could have led to other issues too, right, that might have brought it down. And, you know, you're left with humans making some very, you know, important decisions. And people in even important, you know, men of great integrity, which we're going to assume, you know, people on a Beit Din are, which we saw a couple of weeks ago with the Smicha thing, even if they're very knowledgeable, certainly in matters of Torah, people can make bad judgments. Politically, socially, it happens from time to time because you never know for certain how people are going to react. So, yeah, that is, it's, I mean, look, I think it's one reason why today, I mean, among many reasons why, you know, Batei Din haven't actually executed anyone, you know, but, yeah, something to keep in mind. Anyway, let's move on. So, you know, when we're talking about rabbinic acts of legislation and, you know, what are, you know, the how far can they go with it? One of, I think, the most well-known examples of, you know, a difficult gzeira where they, you know, extend it is Hillel and the Prosbul. Because as the Gemara asks, well, you know, what Hillel basically did was he subverted biblical law, right? At least in, you know, source number 3, the Gemara and Yevamot, yes, they killed someone, but they never actually said that we're supplanting biblical law. They were arguing, at least in their terms, well, we've got our, you know, we have our authority to do this because of Hora'at Sha'ah, you know, because the need requires it, because ultimately, by, you know, executing these people, it's better off for the entire Jewish people. Okay, but what about Hillel? So, I'll take this. So Hillel instituted the Prosbul. We have learned elsewhere, Prosbul prevents the remission of debts in the sabbatical year. This is one of the regulations made by Hillel the Elder, for he saw that people were unwilling to lend money to one another and disregarded the precept laid down in the Torah. Beware that he not base thought in thine heart, saying, etc. He therefore decided to institute the protocol. So according to the Pasuk in Devarim 15, there's, you know, we're told that the year of Shemitah nullifies all debt. And there's a specific biblical prohibition against people not against withholding loans right before Shemitah. Right? So, I mean, this is one example where, you know, the poor have a distinct advantage. Because if it's, you know, right before Shemitah year, poor guy can say to a wealthy guy, hey, can you lend me, let's say, $10,000? Right? So, biblically speaking, if I have the money, I'm supposed to lend it to him, even though knowing that if he doesn't pay me back in a day, I'm never going to see that money again. And the Torah says, nope, still have to, you know, lend him. Don't have that evil heart, your evil thought in your heart saying, don't lend him the money. So, Hillel set up this prosbol to basically, you know, his concern, keep in mind, was that the wealthy were ignoring a biblical law. So, Hillel set up the prosbol so that people wouldn't violate that biblical law of withholding loaning money. So, how did he institute the prosbol? The text of the prosbol is as follows. I hand over to you, so-and-so, the judges in such-and-such a place, my bonds, so that I may be able to recover any money owing to me from so-and-so at any time I shall desire. And the prosbol is to be signed by the judges or witnesses. All right. So the way that this got resolved, basically, was instead of having it as a private debt, you sort of signed the debt over to the beis-din. Think of the beis-din in this case as sort of a corporation, where Shemitah might absolve the private debts, but corporate debts would be something else. So by signing the debts over to the beis-din, the debts would not be wiped out. But it is possible that where, according to the Torah, the seventh year releases, Hillel should ordain, should it not release? Which begs the obvious question, wait a second. Hillel's trying to save biblical law of not withholding loans, yet in doing so, he's effectively overriding another biblical law of when Shemitah comes, loans get wiped out. Right? So how can Hillel HaZakein do that? Whence arrives his authority? He's making a takana, he's making an enactment to say, hey, basically here's a way to get around biblical law. Yeah.
How is it?
The Gemara's going to answer this, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll wait.
Yeah. Wait until we actually get to some of the answers here.
Yeah.
All right. So Abaye said he was dealing with the sabbatical year in our time, and he went on the principle laid down by Rabbi, as it has been taught. Rabbi said, "Now is the matter of the release. Every creditor shall release." The text here indicates two kinds of release: one, the release of land, and the other, release of money. When the release of land is in operation, release of money is to be operative. When the release of land is not operative, the release of money is not to be operative. The rabbis, however, ordained that it should be operative in order to keep alive the memory of the sabbatical year, and when Hillel saw that people refrained from lending money to one another, he decided to institute a prosbol. So one answer is simply that Shemitah, in their day, was not a biblical requirement, but rather a rabbinic enactment. Right? In which case, Hillel's act of legislation did not override biblical law, it only overrode rabbinic law. So that's one approach. Right? But is it possible whether Torah, according to the Torah, the seventh year does not release, the rabbi should ordain that it does release? Same type of question. Abaye replied, it is a case of sit still and do nothing. Something of a shave ve'al ta'ase. I mean, there's a difference that Abaye says between someone who gets up and proactively does something that contradicts the Torah versus you sit and you don't do something that the Torah commands. Rava, however, replied, the rabbis have the power to expropriate for the benefit of the public. Rabbi Isaac has said, how do we know that the rabbis have the power to expropriate? For it says, and that whosoever came not within 3 days according to the counsel of the princes and elders, all his substance shall be forfeited, and himself separated from the congregation of the captivity. Rabbi Elazar said, we derive from here, these are the inheritors which Elazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun, the heads of the fathers of houses, etc., wise fathers put here next to heads, to show that fathers transmit to their children whatever property they wish, that the heads transmit to the public whatever they wish. Principle here in Hebrew is effectively hefker, beitin, hefker. That a beitin has the halachic authority to, what's the good term, basically take away someone's property and give it to someone else. The word hefker makes it, you know, is a way of saying, well, it's nullified, it's now ownerless, and a beit din has the power to do so. So how did the sages, you know, how were they able to do this? You take this idea of the principle. So one, say that it wasn't, you know, Shemitah in their days isn't biblical, it's only rabbinic, and how did the rabbis get away with that in the first place? So either it's a sheva al tase, either because they're not proactively telling you to break biblical law, or alternatively it's because of hefker beit din hefker. Because at the end of the day, they still have a right to appropriate money from one person and give it to someone else. All right. So putting all this together, it's the way that the Gemara answers the question that Hillel did not in fact override biblical law by instituting the principle. Now.
Okay, so there are several ways of overriding biblical laws.
Explain.
Ayin tachat ayin, you can simply say, oh, it doesn't really mean that. Ben sorer moreh, you can interpret the words in such a way that, you know, this business that the father and the mother have to have the same voices, And so you can get around it that way, and I mean that's sort of, it's like it's a loophole. I mean, it's what people say about the Eruv, that it's a way of finding a way to carry, you know, in what really, you know, is public domain.
Okay. So,
but my point is, you're doing it legally. It's not as if you're saying. I mean. Is Prusbul actually contradicting the Torah, or is it finding a loophole in the law that lets you go through this narrow passageway around it?
So that's a very important distinction there. With Ayin Tachat Ayin and Bein Sorer Umoreh, those involve Midrashei Halacha. Those are the legal expositions of biblical verses. Okay? So that's one category of, you know, the halachic process.
Okay.
With what Hillel did, I mean, when you talk about rabbinic enactments, the two big types are gezerot and takanot. Decrees, enactments, I'm not sure how you want to, you know, explain that. Some will explain that a takana is a positive rabbinic enactment and a gezera is a negative one. Whereas the gezerot are more of the preventative measures, and takanot are more positive enactments, things that we're going to do in order to fix something. Here, the language was Hillel Hitkin. Right, and it's using in that language shows that he is in fact innovate. When you use that term of a takana, that's when you are making a full acknowledgement that a rabbi is making an enactment. He is creating something that did not exist before, as opposed to a midrash halacha, which is here's how we're going to interpret a certain verse, right? And the appeal back to the biblical authority, or to even a tradition of authority, like certain things like gzera shava. Method of rabbinic exegesis of finding linguistic or literary parallels from one word in one section to another word in another section, which only works if you have a tradition for that, which we saw in the last class, which, you know, apologize if you're listening, wasn't able to record because the battery died. But yeah, that's a fundamentally different approach to what Jewish law is. With the with takanot, it's a rabbinic enactment. It's understood that it is a rabbinic enactment and a rabbinic invention. So is that, you know, contradicting something that the Torah says? Well, when you're using the term takana, there has to be some, and there could be some ways that you could override, such that if you do have a hora'acha, if there is an emergency dispensation behind something, right, you can make certain takanot in those regards. But there is that understanding that it isn't what the Bible intends, but rather it's something that we're doing ourselves. Believe it or not, conservative Judaism, in some of their responsa, were kind of precise in this, where they make a distinction between an enactment and an interpretation. Whereas something that's an enactment means it really isn't part of the law, but it's something we feel we have to do. Whereas if it's a matter of an interpretation, well, then this is a plausible, legitimate read of the religion as we know it. And I know in that language, I don't say the language of conservative Judaism, because I don't know how many conservative Jews actually feel this way, but in the language of select members of the conservative rabbinate, or at least those in the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, they have a cognizant difference between an enactment and an interpretation, and what that means practically, right? Because if it's an enactment, you can say, well, you don't really believe this, but you feel it's, you know, this is the end result you need. But if it's an interpretation, you are saying that it is part and parcel of, you know, the Jewish system. When Hillel set up the Prizbal, didn't exist beforehand. It was, he saw people were breaking a Jewish law. He said, well, I'm going to have to do this. Was it ideal? Probably not. I mean, ideally, people would still lend money. Although I would actually say that, you know, one huge benefit was, and this is part of the whole economics and social justice series, that the big thing with the Prizbal was that the original system, before he enacted it, you had an imbalance of power. Where according to biblical law, technically speaking, the poor could hold, you know, the wealthy, you know, almost, you know, ransom. Like, everyone could just go, it's like, hi, you know, can I borrow $1 million? And, you know, they'd have to lend them the money or something like that. And, you know, knowing that I have a biblical law to give you money, knowing full well I'm not going to see this money back. Now, that's not a real just system because it allows the poor to take undue advantage of the wealthy. And part of my argument is that the real social justice of Judaism isn't to favor the poor over the wealthy, because that actually violates other biblical laws. It's how do you set up a system where mutual legitimate needs of opposing parties are taken care of. So people who benefit from the Prizbal, you can say, oh, these are the poor people. But the truth is, it's the wealthy too. It's, you could argue that it's a win-win. The poor get their money and the wealthy get their money back, right? So that works, right? Whereas beforehand, you either have the poor people, you know, can't get, either poor people take advantage of the wealthy, or the wealthy violate biblical law that they otherwise wouldn't, you know, might not want to do, but they may not have a financial choice if, you know, they're hit up for too much money, like under Rosh Hashanah v'Shemitah year.
So what would have happened 100 years before Hillel if somebody had gone to a court and said, I'm handing you over my debts?
Yeah, I don't know. There's no like record that I know of you know, people thought of that.
No, but the point is that he's not making a takana. He's just finding a loophole.
When he uses that term hitkin, you know, that means he is making a takana.
No, that's his words. But if you analyze what happened logically,
because the Beit Din Yerseng already existed.
Yeah.
Well, it could be he was the first one to think of it. I mean, look at today, right? The core, you know, we've got a Congress that every now and again actually manages to pass something, right? They're not doing anything new from that regard because they always have the ability to pass laws. But every now and again, you know, someone's going to come up with a new innovative idea that no one thought of before. I'll give you one example. This is one of my all-time favorite pieces of proposed legislation. And some of you might be shocked to know that it came from, at the time, Senator Hillary Clinton. And what this bill was, I forget the name of it and the number, it would have tied the minimum wage increases to congressional pay raises, such that every time Congress voted itself a pay raise, the minimum wage would go up. And I thought that was a genius legislation. I don't know anyone who did it before. Now, the minimum wage already exists, and there's been lots of, you know, attempts to raise the minimum wage. Congressional pay raises? Sure, that's gone on for a while. Who thought to connect the two? Far as I know, the first person was Hillary Clinton. And if it wasn't her, then whoever came up with it, right? But that's how legislation works. The mechanisms might have already existed, but sometimes it takes someone to actually say, hey, let's do it. Also, it could be a matter of, you know, authority. Like, Hillel Zeckman was pretty well respected, right? I come up with a lot of ideas. Very few people listen to my ideas. And you could argue with good reason. Like, healthcare. I would sooner nationalize medical schools than the whole entire healthcare system. Why? You lower the cost of entry into the medical field, maybe medical care wouldn't cost so much. I also had an idea that to make sure that government budgets don't go overboard so often, hold the legislatures who vote for public works projects personally financially accountable if stuff goes over budget. So to give them some incentive to make sure that they actually get the stuff done and paid on time. Right? Now, these are ideas that I have. You know what? No one's listening to me because Rabbi of a small shul in, you know, Lower East Side. Right? So it could be, you know, people might have thought of it before, and it just took someone like Hillel to really, you know, concretize it, to get it, you know, have it gain widespread acceptance. Or it could be that no one, in fact, did think of it before. And he was like, even though it existed, he was the first, like, you know what? this can work, or I'm going to use a pre-existing system to come up with something else. I mean, you were also here for the Aguna class on the halachic prenup, right? And we saw that just how almost identical that was to the Lieberman clause, and yet people tell us, like, oh, you know, this is the greatest thing ever. This is, you know, mark of, like, spectacular halachic innovation. It's like, no, you did a couple of tweaks to something that was 40 years old. Like, you know, big deal. But, you know, that's just how it works. Anyway, so one of the, you know, probably most important things that come up with the Takanot are limitations that Batei Din have, specifically regarding overturning stuff. And the source for this is really the beginning of Beitza. Starts, you know, this particular sugya starts at 3, goes to 5. We're not going to do the whole sugya. We're just going to do a small paragraph here. Dan, take it, Beitza 5b.
What is meant by, and scripture further says, he means thus, consider, it is written, be ready against the third day, come not near a woman. Then what is the purpose of, go say to them, return you to your tents? Infer therefrom that every prohibition decided by a majority vote requires another majority vote to rescind it. And should you reply, it comes as a command concerning conjugal duties, then come and hear, when the trumpet sounds long, they shall come up to the mount. Now consider, it is written, neither let the flocks nor herds feed before the mount. Then what is the purpose of, when the trumpet sounds long, they should come up to the mount? Conclude therefrom that what has been prohibited by a majority vote requires another majority vote to rescind it.
Plain English here. When you had the Shloshet Yemei Hagbalah, before the Torah was given, Jewish people had to separate from the mountain for 3 days. Now, we're also told that they were given specific permissions, like after the 3 days, like, okay, everything's back to normal. Now, why is that, you know, big deal? It's like, wait, but you said 3 days. After 3 days, it should be automatic. Shema Mine. So from what we learn from here, the most, I think, important, you know, words in terms of the halachic process, kol davar shebim minyan tzarich minyan acharav lahatiro. Any act of legislation that was done through the court needs another court's ruling to overturn it. Even if the time, there was a built-in time limit and the time expires, which is pshat in the Gemara here, or even if the reason goes away, batel ta'ame no batel gezerah, the reason goes away, the legislation doesn't go away either. And it's in those words that you've got a whole slew of arguments that we're going to see, you know, over coming weeks. Of kol davar shebinyan tzarich minyan acharav lahatiro, and what are the parameters and the arguments that people have over that. According to straight Gemara, as long as you have a legislated takan or gzera, you need a formal act of legislation to overturn that. Whereas, I mean, the truth is, in Ashkenazi, you know, practice, certainly more than Sephardi, are colossally inconsistent about this in terms of when, you know, what point do you say that, oh, the reason goes away or the reason's no longer applicable, so therefore the law doesn't apply anymore. According to the Gemara, certainly based on this Gemara in Beitza, doesn't matter. As long as there was a takana, as long as this was a halacha, doesn't matter why. All that matters is that this is the decree and you got to keep it. We saw this, might actually bring back, were you in the class for Maritayan? May have to bring that back as part of. All right, you know
probably.
What? Well, I don't remember it because I gave it a long time ago.
It wasn't part of current issues then.
No.
Okay.
I'll bring back. You know what? We'll add that to the class on the halachic process of Maritayan. So one of the issues with Maritayan is these are, you know, zero. These were decrees that were made. Certain things were prohibited. Lest someone come to see what you're doing, and a lot more elaboration on that. But the important thing with something that was forbidden because of Marit Ayin is also forbidden in your Chadre Chadarim, in your innermost room, which makes sense. Following Kol Davar Shebim Minyan Tzarich Minyan Acharav LaHatiro, it doesn't matter that it was done because of Marit Ayin. All that matters is Chazal said it was Usser. The reason doesn't matter. If the reason mattered, then you should be able to do it in private. The only reason why it doesn't matter in private is because the reason doesn't matter. And this comes up in a whole bunch of other issues, which, you know, we'll see how other people, you know, deal with that. But yeah, I mean, this explains it, you know, also in terms of why, you know, you want to say about why can't people do certain things today? And the answer is really a matter of authority. Like, who is the Beis Din that has the authority to overturn a previous Takanat Chazal? Yeah.
I guess what bothers me is that that seems to me to be a workable modus vivendi, as long as you always have an authority there. So if you have Congress there,
yeah,
and Congress sits there and says, we're not going to overturn this, we're
yeah
not going to repeal this,
yep,
then you say, okay, there's some logic to it. But it breaks down when you don't have a Congress anymore.
What do you mean by breakdown?
You get laws on the books that if only there were a Congress, it would have been repealed.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have to observe one thing after another that makes no sense to us today.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if I can give you an example. I'm just
saying. Look, I mean, there are times when people will actually say that. So, to anticipate, what some people would say later on is that, well, maybe if the reason was, quote, built in to the takana, then if the reason goes away, the law doesn't apply more. So here's one example that Ashkenazim in particular ignore, more than Sfarim, I think, but it's possible Sfarim. Technically speaking, you're not allowed to clap your hands or dance on Shabbat or Yom Tov. That's clear. It's a Mishnah, Beitzah 36b. Gemara discusses it in 30a. Tosfot there says, well, and the Gemara explains that it's because Shem Yitakin Klishir. You may come to fix a musical instrument. And Tosfot on 30a says that, well, that applied when people knew how to fix musical instruments. Today we don't know how to fix musical instruments, so it doesn't make sense to, have the law anymore. That's Tosfot, right? Basically saying, law doesn't matter anymore yet. So really have no problem doing this. Other things seem to be kept by, practice, such as eating fish and meat on the same plate. The Gemara says as a matter of sakana, as a matter of danger. Is that a matter of danger today? No. Right?
And is the idea that a fish bone would be left on the plate and you'd swallow it with the meat?
But there are easier, whatever people come up with a sakana, today there's really no such danger. I mean, there are enough people in the world today. You have no problem eating fish and meat on this. I mean, non-kosher restaurants have surf and turf as, some of them have a surf and turf dish. Like, it's not uncommon enough. You just say, what sakana is there? And yeah, people today are going to be crazy meticulous over that. Why? Does that make any sense? It makes as much sense as something else. Now, if you want to say do things on the book that don't make sense to us today, if you're going to use your criteria as, quote, making sense and rationality, well then, we can really knock out most of religion, because most of religion doesn't make sense from a pure rational perspective, because it involves a God, it involves a God communicating to man and telling, people, hey, this is what I want you to do.
But it was still a viable system.
So when you say viable system, so you want to say viable system in terms of keeping things current, yeah, it helps a lot more when the body is still in existence. Today, yeah, in some respects, the system has kind of broken down because we don't have a Sanhedrin. But I'd also say that not as much as people might think. Because when you don't have those extra gzeirot and takanot, the corollary is today, no one has the authority to make universal rulings that are binding on all Jews. Right? So you've got a lot more freedom in that regard. Are there things that we don't do today that in theory, we ought to? And look, the discussion of this Gemara and Beitzah that came up is really about Yom Tov Sheni, right? Which I know is a classic one that people like saying, we have a calendar. But even in the time of the Gemara, they recognize, we don't technically need Yom Tov Sheni anymore. I said, we need it for whatever, reason. Right? Unless someone come mess up the calendar, we'll have to go back to the old system. Was it an anachronism in the time of Chazal? Yeah. Did they keep it? Yeah. Does that mean that the system is flawed? Not necessarily. I would say, we're probably harmed more by not having a Sanhedrin that can actually legislate new stuff that's more appropriate than undoing older rabbinic enactments, just in terms of conflict stuff. And I don't think practically it comes up that much. I'll give you one example that came up. I was asking one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU that I could speak to about software piracy, music and software piracy, and did it violate any extant Jewish law? And I argued no. in that I try, and I, you know, tried the other way. I said, let's, you know, come up with a list of all, you know, what possible categories could it be? And it just, I mean, Dina Demakut is a separate question, but like, you know, about stealing, you know, about other damages, and it just, I argue that it couldn't. I sat and went with him, and this Rosh Yeshiva's response was, quote, I'm sure if we had a Sanhedrin today, they would aser it. And I said, so you're saying it's mutter. And he kind of got annoyed at that point. But that was kind of, you know, where the argument goes. So if he did have a Sanhedrin, then yeah, you know, we could have, you know, this is what all Jews should be doing, but we don't. And a lot would depend today on who would actually be on the Sanhedrin. But that's a whole other question. Point for our discussion, though, is to have the legislative act that's binding on all Jews, you need to have that legislative act from a Davar Shebin Minyan, from that actual quorum. That's what really matters in terms of setting up Jewish law that's normative for the entire nation. And it means you need that body to overturn a previous one. That is a pretty big deal. The only exceptions that you may have today is something like Hora'at Sha'a, something like an emergency dispensation. Then we can argue who has a right to come up with that and under which situations. There's no rabbi that I know of who's a rabbi of a shul where everyone in the shul does what he wants people to do. Never happens of 100% people listen to the rabbi. And there's sometimes when rabbis are going to have to compromise because, you know, for a greater good. Right? So, like, you know, here, this shul, I'm not a fan that Shabbos davening starts at 9:30, but I understand the need why it has to be for this shul. So for me, I could say, sorry, no, kind of haracha. Is that ideal? No. Do I think it's a good thing? No, because most of the year it's after Sosman Kriyat Shema. Depending on when people get up, it gets very dicey with Sosman Tefillah. Not ideal, but it's necessary. And, you know, we can argue about individual judgments there, but when you're talking about a halachic process, and maybe we can do a special class on haracha too, but at least in terms of a legislative process, you can overturn for all of Klausau and saying this no longer, I mean, there's a very big difference to say, here's what we need to do here for reason X, Y, or Z, and this is no longer the law. Not unlike a difference saying, here's what the Torah means versus here's my takana. It's here's what we have to do here, like in this time and space, versus here's what the law is that is binding on all Jews for all times. Okay? I'll do the last one here. Bava Batra 60b. It has been taught, Rav Ishmael ben Elisha said, since the day of the destruction of the temple, we should by rights bind ourselves not to eat meat nor drink wine. Only we do not lay a hardship on the community unless the majority can endure it. And from the day that a government has come to power, which issues cruel decrees against us and forbids us to observance of the Torah and the precepts and does not allow us to enter the, quote, week of the sun, according to another version, the salvation of the sun, we ought by rights bind ourselves not to marry and beget children, and the seed of Abraham, our father, will come to an end itself. Whoever let Israel go their way, it is better they should err in ignorance rather than presumptuously. Don't want to get into the Shvua Taben here, or the Yeshua Taben, or whatever that is. Two important points here to mention is one, Ein gozerin gezerah ala tzibur, ela imken rov hatzibur yecholin la'amod ba. You don't make a decree or any sort of enactment unless the majority of the community can sustain it. Right? So as much power as you want to say the rabbis have, there's that recognition that people have to do what you say, and you need to have a certain amount of sense that people are actually going to follow it. And then there's that last line of Hanachlem Lisa Mutav Shishogigim Valu Mizidin. There's sometimes when rabbis just have to learn to let things go when they know people aren't going to listen to them. One of the other examples is in fact the dancing and clapping on Shabbat and Yom Tov, where, you know, issue came up and someone didn't criticize, and I said, Mutav Shishogim Valu Mizidin. They're not going to listen to me. Better they just do it. Like, you're not saying it is permitted. You're saying that better that they sin in error rather than sin intentionally. And that's an important point in the halachic process, too. So you put these two things together, right? On one hand, you can say that, oh, the rabbis are just completely, you know, that they're running a, what's the term? I don't want to say dictatorship, a oligarchy, whatever system that is, right? But, you know, they've got this, you know, body, and they rule over the Jewish people with an iron fist. there is that recognition that that's really not the case. When you're talking about Gzeirot and Takanot, when you're talking about new enactments that rabbis themselves are making up because they think it is a good thing, they think it is necessary for the preservation of Torah to prevent people from sinning more, there has to be that practical recognition that people have to live with it. And in order to do that, you have to say, you know what, if people aren't going to follow it, you know what, we're just going to, you know, we're going to take it past. Might it be ideal? Sure. But if it can't be done, it can't be done. And there, you can say that's, you know, more pragmatism than anything else, but it still is halachic pragmatism. So if you try to come up with exera, here's what everything has to do, you don't just throw out stringencies. You know what, I should probably add this too, to the stringency class. But yeah, you don't just throw out stuff on the Jewish people. You always say like, oh, you know, we're going to start banning this and that and that. It's like, well, if most people aren't going to do it, well, you really shouldn't be doing that. At least that's part of the halachic process, is knowing your crowd.
Ah, but the definition of crowd.
Right. So the question is then, who's considered the tzibor?
Right.
Which is a fun question. Like, you know, do we is the tzibor like just the people in your immediate vicinity? Is the tzibor, you know, and I would guess, or at least the way that I would understand this is, the tzibor would be the people who are at least under your jurisdiction. So for me, my tzibor would be the shul, right? So I wouldn't come up with something for the shul if I didn't think people in the shul would be able to do it. If I'm the Sanhedrin and my tzibor is then all of Klal Yisrael, well then my concern is Klal Yisrael, right? But then there would be, but then you would have to be limiting and acknowledging that you're limiting your authority, that you don't speak for all the Jewish people, or at least unless you're the Sanhedrin. But like, you know, any rabbi today doesn't speak for all of Klal Yisrael. They speak for their own little kehillah, their own little communities. And for your own little communities, okay, do what you want. But there's a very big difference between saying, here's what we're going to do in our community versus here's what the law is that's binding on every single Jew and in all time and space, or at least from here on out, right? Because that today, no one's got the authority. This will be the last class until after the Chagim because, you know, starting to get in, you know, really intense mode. But we can pick up some stuff afterwards with some other dimensions in the rabbinic era of the halachic process, and then we'll get to later, like medieval interpretations of how halacha works, and we'll see how things play up with a Gemara. Now that, you know, after we've seen enough sources, we may be able to understand more of like, where did different, say, Rishonim get certain sources from? How consistent are they with the Gemara, and how much that matters? And we may go to more modern stuff too. All right. So, since it'll be a while, have everyone a Shana Tovah, a Kasher B'Sameach, and probably see you in a month or so, give or take. You all.